A lab full of mosquitoes today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Researchers in Brazil are working overtime to find a solution to the Zika crisis, and that means studying the principal culprits, mosquitoes.
In this room is around 10,000 to 15,000 mosquitoes.
Very buggy research. Also, a Nevada Latino tells me what he thinks of the two Latino Republicans running for president, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio.
The reality is that those two are candidates who have long forgotten what it means to be a Latino in this country and to struggle.
Plus, the British Conservatives doing battle over Europe, London Mayor Boris Johnson versus Prime Minister David Cameron.
If you were going to give this a score so far, it has to be 1-0 to Boris.
That's all today on The World. Glad you could be with us this Monday. I've got a few more Tehran stories to tell you, one coming later today. Two young Iranian women with a keen eye for design and skills aplenty on a lathe and bandsaw. But first, our Across Women's Lives team is in Brazil all this week. They'll be bringing us stories about women and the environment. You can follow along on social media using the hashtag #HerPlanet. Right now, the big story affecting women in Brazil is the Zika outbreak. That's because there's growing evidence the Zika virus can cause terrible birth defects. Many researchers are trying to figure out how Zika works, while others are hoping to stop mosquitoes from spreading the virus in the first place. Here's The World's Carolyn Beeler.
Professor Adriano Mondini is on a public health mission. He's collecting mosquitoes outside of a house in Araraquara, about a three-hour drive northwest of Sao Paulo.
This patient was positive for dengue, so we're collecting the mosquitoes in her house to test them for dengue.
Mondini's student Paulo Lopez walks around with a little vacuum tube, trying to suck up mosquitoes where they like to lurk.
Wet places around the house and some dark places around the corner.
Mondini will test the mosquitoes that Lopez collects for dengue, but also for the Zika virus, as he started doing recently. The Brazilian government says somewhere between 400,000 and 1.5 million people may have been infected with Zika in less than a year. Most likely won't even notice any effects, but in a few cases, the consequences may be dire, from temporary paralysis to severe birth defects. That's why researchers here are on the hunt for both the virus and the mosquitoes that carry it.
If we find it here, it means that we have a mosquito population that can transmit Zika virus. And it's good because Dr. Capurro is going to work with that. I'm going to work with that.
Dr. Capurro is Dr. Margaret Capurro. To mix insect metaphors here, if Mondini is a worker bee in the fight against Zika spreading mosquitoes, Capurro may just be the queen. She's coordinating the mosquito research of a new Zika network of around 40 labs in Brazil, including researchers like Mondini.
We are going to bring from the field different populations of mosquitoes to understand how is the dynamic of the interaction with the virus.
Capurro is a biologist at the University of Sao Paulo. She's been researching mosquitoes for nearly 30 years, and she was on her way to retirement when the Zika outbreak hit. Perhaps that idea still survives in her choice of footwear. She wears flip-flops. But she's thrown herself back into her work, using her connections to gather mosquitoes from around Brazil to study their genetic differences.
If we have mosquitoes that are susceptible and mosquitoes that are totally immune, the idea is to compare the genome between them to see which is the difference. Because if we have this information, we can have targets for insecticides, or modify mosquitoes to block the transmission of the disease.
Using that information, one possible method to block the transmission of the disease would be to breed lots of these immune mosquitoes.
You can introduce this population in the places that they have mosquitoes with a very bad infection.
Essentially, she would replace Zika-carrying mosquitoes with Zika-immune ones. She's done something similar with genetically modified sterile male mosquitoes in a pilot program to fight dengue. It's not yet clear if that kind of program could really scale up to an effective level. But still, she's charging ahead, starting in her breeding lab for the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes that carry Zika.
This is the insect room. Insectarium? Yeah, I don't know. In this room, we need to have a procedure to enter.
The room has a sort of airlock to trap mosquitoes if they escape from their containers. Inside, there are tall shelves filled with small plastic containers and larger screen boxes of Aedes aegypti. If you're really quiet, you can even hear them buzzing.
In this room is around 10,000 to 15,000 mosquitoes.
Kapuro is working a number of angles here, including experimenting with what she calls a suicidal mosquito that would self-destruct if it were infected with Zika. Of course, there are big questions about the unintended consequences of introducing genetically modified insects into the wild, but those come later. First, Kapuro has to make her idea work.
If works, this is the problem, okay? This is science. You know, you'll never know.
What Kapuro and her colleagues do know is that the Zika threat is just the tip of a very big iceberg here. The same mosquitoes that carry Zika also carry dengue, yellow fever, and chikungunya. And while the threat from Zika is still uncertain, the threat for dengue is very clear. It killed nearly 900 people in Brazil alone last year. When I asked Adriano Mondini which virus worried him more, he didn't hesitate.
We had like 35 years of dengue transmission in Brazil and millions of cases, and deaths are going higher each year. So I think I have answered your question.
But Zika is new and mysterious and scary, so it's bringing in lots of new money for mosquito research, and that likely will help in the fight against all of these diseases. For her part, Margaret Kapuro knows a lot of the research she's overseeing for the Zika network won't make it out of the lab. But she says at this point, every new experiment is worth it.
I always say that about mosquitoes or about the dengue or the disease, we need to think as a general, it's a war. We need to send everything that we have, not only soldiers.
You can see a video from inside that mosquito lab. We posted it at PRI.org/womenslives. Carolyn Beeler joins me now from Rio de Janeiro. Carolyn, just watching that video made me want to grab some bug spray. How are your defenses?
We are safe here in Rio, but there were some escaped mosquitoes in that lab at Margaret Campuro's lab at the University of Sao Paulo, so bug spray wouldn't have been a bad idea.
So I know you were in the house of somebody who had dengue, but what about Zika?
So far, as of last week, there were 2 confirmed cases of Zika in Araraquara, which, by the way, is now my new favorite word. And sort of as a reminder that this sort of public health outbreak or crisis impacts public health workers often first and worst, one of those impacted was one of the students who goes around with Professor Mondini collecting samples for testing. So she probably got infected while she was out doing work. So a good reminder of who's sort of at risk here.
Right. So this research is just starting, but do you have any sense of kind of how long it's going to take to find newer effective measures to control mosquitoes?
Well, as Margaret Kapuro is sort of the first to say, it's really a question of if more than when. But she is hoping that some of the things she's looking into that I mentioned in my story, best case scenario, they could turn into something useful in about 2 years. So really, this is the long view here.
Carolyn Beeler there with our Across Women's Lives team in Rio de Janeiro. Tomorrow, our coverage from Brazil continues. We'll hear what it's like to parent a baby with microcephaly. It's not something you do alone. These mothers in Brazil got together for a party after networking with a smartphone app. It's great for sharing medical and parenting tips and for finding families facing similar challenges as microcephaly. We'll have that story for you tomorrow. Water plays an important part in our next story as well. You've undoubtedly heard about the water in Flint, Michigan, contaminated by lead after the water supply was swapped out to save money almost 2 years ago. All of Flint's residents are struggling with the contamination, but one group is having an especially hard time of it, the 1,000 undocumented immigrants, mostly from Mexico, who call the city home. From Flint, Jean Carstensen has our story.
Juani Olivares was born in Mexico, but she's lived in Flint since she was 10 years old. She's now leading the effort to get the undocumented community the information and services they need to cope with the city's lead crisis.
We've been going door to door to collect information if they have water, if they need medical services, and whatever their basic needs they may have.
The news about lead poisoning has been slow to reach this community. Until recently, the public messages were only in English, and undocumented residents didn't qualify for health services, including lead testing.
They cannot receive any health services because they don't have insurance or a valid ID, so they're being denied those services, getting tested for lead.
And some people have been afraid to access services for fear of outing themselves to authorities. Juani agrees to introduce me to an undocumented family willing to share their story. Until a month ago, they were still using Flint tap water.
Not at this light, but the second light, you can make a left.
On the way to their house, I asked Juani to show me around East Flint, the neighborhood where many undocumented immigrants live. It's where Juani grew up.
And luckily, there's not so much traffic in Flint, so I can drive and record at the same time.
Right. It's a good thing.
We drive down streets lined with small wooden houses on big grassy lots with tall trees. It must have been an appealing neighborhood at one time, but now many of the houses are burned or boarded up. She points out a building where she went to school.
This is where all the Hispanic kids came to school. They had the bilingual program. So I have really good memories. It's sad to see it closed.
Just before we reach our destination, Juani shows me the empty lot where her childhood home once stood.
So you see where that tree's at up the front, like right in the middle? That's where our house used to be. I remember summertime, our friends would come over, parents are cooking out, and now there's like nobody here.
We finally stop a few blocks away at a small yellow house with peeling paint. We meet Carolina, who doesn't want us to use her last name. Like Juani's family, Carolina and her husband came from Mexico to find work and to give their four daughters a better life. But Carolina tells me that since the water crisis, she's worried about their future, especially her one-year-old.
Now I'm more worried about her because I drank the water during the entire pregnancy, and now she's probably sick with something.
Carolina explains she heard something about Flint's water being contaminated back in April. The family quit drinking it, but continued to use it for cooking and bathing until just 1 month ago, because that's when she finally learned about the lead in the tap water. Now the family uses only bottled water, but Carolina is just now realizing what it could mean that they used lead-contaminated water for almost 2 years. She reads to me from a flyer that an aid worker gave her just that morning. It's the first printed information they've received in Spanish.
Cansancio todo el tiempo, debilidad muscular.
She reads off a list of symptoms. Her daughters have been sick a lot with headaches and body aches, and the baby has had constant rashes since birth. The flyer explains some of the potential consequences of lead poisoning, including learning disabilities and stunted growth. Carolina is scared she may have been unwittingly poisoning her girls.
Why didn't they say anything? If they would have told us the water was contaminated, we would have done things differently.
I can't help wondering if the family would feel safer moving back to Mexico. But Carolina fears that with all the lead exposure, it may already be too late.
Aunque nos mudemos, no porque nos vayamos de otra casa, se va a quitar de eso, se quitara, pues me mudo cada rato y...
Leaving or moving to another house isn't going to get rid of this. The harm has been done.
Juani and I say goodbye to Carolina and head back outside. I ask her, does she ever think about leaving Flint?
I have thought about it, but not right now. I think it won't be until I know that my people have been taken care of.
For The World, Jean Carstensen, Flint, Michigan.
Coming up, London's outspoken mayor is at it again. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The rush to woo the Latino vote has been getting hot and heavy in Nevada. Democrats went to the polls on Saturday. The GOP takes its turn tomorrow. One in four Nevada residents is Hispanic, and I've got one of them with me now. He's Leo Murrieta, 29 years old and a volunteer for Hillary Clinton's campaign in Nevada.
As a Nevadan, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't point out that our state's called Nevada, not Nevada. But my family came to this country when I was 7 days old. My parents were pastors through the evangelical church, and they were sent here as missionaries. And I was supposed to be born in the United States on the Arizona side of the border, but I was actually born on the way to the border. So I was born two villages from the American crossing. And so I have a brother and a sister who are undocumented. Me getting a green card was very difficult, but we were blessed very last minute to get a green card for myself. So I've actually lived here in Las Vegas since I was roughly a week old.
Wow. So as I said, you're a precinct captain with Hillary Clinton's campaign in Nevada. When you look at the roster of presidential candidates, what is the big issue that you're looking at when trying to figure out who to support?
For me, my mother was diagnosed with cancer several years ago, and so taking care of her proved to be one of our family's most difficult challenges. My father suffered a stroke and a brain aneurysm in 2001, and so healthcare is a gigantic issue. I'm really concerned about workers' rights, taking care of Medicare and Social Security for my parents. I myself, I'm openly gay, so I consistently worry about my trans brothers and sisters across the country and LGBT equality. And of course, the underlying tone of all of this is the consistent fear that my family's been living in for well over a decade, that we have two of our family members with orders of deportation that are more than 10 years old.
How much do you think you represent Latinos in Nevada right now?
I think that a lot of Latino families have gone through the same issue and have similar concerns. During the economic downturn, we went from a five-income household to a one-income household. All of us lost our jobs in the downturn in the economy. We relied on my father's salary as a custodian. And the real struggle was then also we lost our home to foreclosure. My story is not uncommon. I'm pretty sure if you talk to a lot of folks who really survived the downturn and survived the crisis in our economy, that you're going to hear similar stories.
You've spent thousands of hours making calls, canvassing for Hillary Clinton. Why'd you settle on Hillary Clinton?
I grew up with LGBT discrimination. I've seen it firsthand. And for me as an openly gay person and as an advocate, I'm looking for not just a supporter like we have in Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders, but when Secretary Clinton was Secretary of State, she took it a lot further and she sat down with foreign diplomats and really pushed equality across the globe. And my family needs immigration reform. We need to be relieved of the fear of deportation. With Secretary Clinton, we have her talking about eliminating the 3- and 10-year bars. We have her talking about accountability with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. We have her talking about the bipartisan victories that we can get right now and that can bring immediate relief to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of families. And for me, I want to make sure that my family stays together.
Leo Murrieta, a 29-year-old precinct captain for Hillary Clinton's campaign in Nevada. That's Nevada, not Nevada. Leo, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
By the way, we'll be checking in with volunteers and staffers from various campaigns, Democrat and Republican, throughout the year. Time now for a story about a political maverick, an outsized character with a dedicated following and a unique hairstyle. Not Donald Trump. I'm talking about Boris Johnson, the mayor of London. And now, once again, Mr. Mayor is in the thick of it. He says he will campaign for Britain to get out of the European Union, which puts him at odds with British Prime Minister David Cameron, who wants to keep the UK in the European Union. Sonia Purnell is the author of Just Boris, A Tale of Blonde Ambition, the biography of Boris Johnson. Tell us who Boris Johnson is, Sonia, and why he's so different from the run of ordinary British politicians. And since your book is A Tale of Blonde Ambition, start with his hair.
Yeah, his hair is amazing, and it's what everyone remembers and thinks about when they talk about Boris. A bit like Donald Trump. You mentioned Donald Trump just now. The hair defines the man. That blonde ambition very much defines him. He is someone who is a maverick, as you said. He's a big character. He doesn't play by the rules. You know, there are lots of parallels here with Donald Trump, actually. Even if he proclaims not to be a Donald Trump fan, there are lots of things that they share in common. This feeling that somehow that they can relate to everyday people. Boris has this habit of looking into the camera when he's on TV, so it's almost as if he's addressing you when you're at home in your kitchen or your sitting room or something. He calls people friends. He doesn't actually empathise terribly well one-to-one, but with a crowd, he does it really well. And he presents himself as someone who is out there for everyday people who can empathize with them and is sort of the non-politician, if you like. Mm. Of course, that's not the real Boris. The real Boris is a really ambitious, quite ruthless person, determined to be prime minister. But by creating that persona, that friendly, slightly shambolic character that he presents to the world, it makes it easier for him to advance.
And, and he does have his eyes on 10 Downing Street? He wants a premiership?
Oh, yeah. Mm. I mean, he always has. Every fibre of his being desires that job, everything in his life to date. Each one has been a step towards trying to get into Downing Street. There's no doubt about that, absolutely. But he's done it with charm. He tries to diffuse this idea of being ambitious or ruthless by joking, by pretending to be a bit shambolic, by messing up his hair. You know, his hair's always standing up on end. Actually, naturally, it's quite neat hair, but that sort of denotes too much ambition. So he messes it up. Huh. He wears strange hats and anoraks and things. But it's all part of the act. It's a brilliant one.
I guess this wasn't a total surprise to you because you used to work with Boris Johnson when he was a journalist reporting on the EU in Brussels. What are your memories of him?
Well, you know, he was one of the most inventive writers you'll ever come across. A lot of his stories were very creative. I mean, he claimed that the EU was going to ban prawn cocktail flavoured crisps, or chips, as you would say in the States, which are a big favourite here in the UK. Absolutely not true. He claimed that the EU was going to make fishermen wear hairnets. He claimed that the EU was going to insist that bananas be straightened, that the EU was going to build a building something like a mile high. I mean, all sorts of really crazy stuff. Very fun, very inventive, made his name. But all along, you know, I was working alongside him there in Brussels, and during sort of quiet moments when we had a chat, he had actually had great affection for the EU, had a great affection for the people who worked in it. So you had sort of public Boris masterminding his campaign, his political campaign, even while being a journalist. And then you have private Boris, who was quite different and a real European at heart, speaks many languages. His daughter was born in Brussels. He went to school in Brussels. He is brilliant at getting attention for himself and then, you know, bringing it to his own advantage.
Sonia Purnell, author of Just Boris, A Tale of Blonde Ambition. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Tehran, I met two young women who started their own woodworking shop and really, really love their job.
It's my life. No, it's not different from... Yeah. It's for us, just for us. We enjoy it.
Work is our life, it's our hobby, it's everything.
Meet Negin and Shahia coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. In a few minutes, we'll have another of my Tehran stories. Today, I meet up with two young women who have landed on a totally non-traditional way of making a living in the Iranian capital, if you're female. First, though, a Tehran story about a new smartphone app called Gershad. It just launched last week. The idea behind the app is, or was, to help Iranians get around the morality police. I got more details from BBC reporter Farhanak Amidi.
Well, there are a variety of things that you can get into trouble for. Women, usually it's the headscarf, the color of the headscarf, the way they wear the headscarf, the tightness of the manteau or the long coat that they have to wear. If you're showing ankle or a bit of skin, or you're wearing nail polish, all of this for women can cause problem. Also, who you have in your car, for instance, if it's a man that you're not really related to, it's not your brother or father or uncle or husband, you can actually get in trouble. The kind of music you're playing in the car, how loud your music is, all of this. If you have booze in the car also.
Yeah, certainly, right.
Yeah, all of this can actually get you in trouble. So it's a wide range of things.
And what kind of trouble? If you're a woman and your hijab isn't kind of fully on your head, what could happen to you?
usually the kind of punishment changes. So every 6 months or every year, they come up with new fines and new punishments or ways to treat the problem, as they call it. If you're in a car, your car can be towed and put in a parking. Depending on how many times this has happened before, then that will determine how long your car will be kept in a parking. So, or confiscated, for instance, then you have to pay a fine. Sometimes, depending on how severe the crime is, you might be taken to jail also.
What about your own experience growing up in Iran? What was that like? What was your worst brush with the morality police?
Well, you know, I left Iran in 2009, but until then, when I was younger and, you know, a teenager or in my early 20s and I was really rebellious, I did get in a lot of trouble, especially for partying. Parties in Iran are underground.
Were you partying with alcohol or just any party?
The parties we went to had alcohol in it. So, but once my experience is that once I was in a party and the party was raided, and some of us were able to escape. Some of us weren't able to escape. I was one of those who wasn't able to escape. And we were taken to jail.
For how long?
We stayed overnight. In the morning, a cleric came and then they just lined us up in front of him. We had actually signed something like a confession that we were in this party and there was alcohol. And so the cleric basically just looked at the statements and the confessions, basically. And he said, okay, this person gets this many lashes, that person gets that many lashes. And well, the host of the party actually got 90 lashes.
90.
90.
What about you?
I got 10. I was really lucky and I had my clothes on, so I really didn't get bruised or anything. But it was a scary and kind of humiliating experience.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It is frightening, but it's also amazing how young people go through that and they continue doing their own thing.
Well, I think this new app, Gershad, kind of speaks to that, at least the few minutes it was up and running. If it were still running, I mean, it was launched and then the government shut it down. How did it actually work? Do you understand it?
From what I understood, people actually put data into it and information. So if you go through a route and you see the patrol, you can put information there so other people will know that on that route there is a morality police.
Right, so
patrol.
Kind of crowdsourced map information.
Yeah.
Don't go through that intersection because
the morality
police might be there.
And with these things, you know, new things are going to pop up any minute.
The BBC's Farhanak Amidi there. Now, let me tell you about a couple of young women I met when I was in Tehran about a week ago. All around me, I saw big changes going on and young people building lives for themselves in the space those changes have opened up. Some had returned to Tehran from abroad, but others never left.
My name is Negin Nasiri. I'm 26 years old. I studied sculpture at Tehran University.
Not so long ago, Negin Nasiri told me that she really wanted to get out of Iran. She actually had a plan that was almost fully baked. She got accepted to a grad program at California State University, but the U.S. government didn't grant her a visa. Negin's best friend from college, Shahriyah Jahanbani, was delighted with this news and did not contain her joy. Shahriyah never wanted to leave Iran and didn't want Negin to leave either.
Never.
She won't kill me.
It's so hard for me when Negin accepted that university. I was so depressed, but I'm glad that she didn't get the visa. I'm the devil.
Hardly. Shahriyah and Negin have long been sisters in design, and thanks in part to that visa rejection, a blessing in disguise, Negin and Shahriyah are now design and business partners, successful business partners. I met them at the little workshop in Tehran, where the two women design and build custom furniture. Their company is called Studio On. They've been in business for a couple of years now. The first steps were baby steps and not encouraging.
Everything was such a mess. We didn't know anything. After 6 months of working, we had an exhibition. We didn't sell anything. everyone just come to our exhibition and say, wow, it's beautiful. Bye.
Nagin says people weren't buying because their work looked so different. So they decided to make that their calling card, creating custom pieces to order for buyers.
We made something for people that 1 centimeter less or more is important for them. 1 step of darker blue or lighter blue is important for them.
So you do a lot of custom work.
Yes, exactly.
Exclusively custom?
It's completely customized our work. And now, after a year from that exhibition, we didn't sell anything. We have lots of orders.
In fact, Nagin told me they had to stop taking new orders up through Iranian New Year next month just to keep up with demand. It's the finish that makes their furniture unique. When you look at what's available in the furniture stores of Tehran, either affordable and royally ostentatious or very expensive imported Italian stuff, Nagin and Shahia seem to have cornered the funky modern colors and prints market. They don't talk about their printing process. That's a trade secret. As for women doing this work, Nagin says she and Shahia are the first real carpenter girls of Tehran, though she doubts they're the first ever. They're just living in a different time. But still, they're not like most other young women in Tehran today.
Perhaps it's Iranian culture. It's not good that you say everything about yourself, you know? But we know that we are different from other girls.
So just to be certain, you're not egotistical. You're just looking around you and saying, we are different.
Yeah, exactly.
In their green coveralls, Nagin and Shahia look more like factory workers than entrepreneurs. But when they start talking about branding and web design, they sound a lot like startup people I've met in Boston or San Francisco. Not only has it kept these two college friends together, Nagin says their business has given her a completely different outlook on life in Tehran.
Before I start this work, I hate my city. So I hate Iran. I won't go for study, something else. I don't want to live here. The traffic, the pollution, everything was bad. But now everything is good because my life in city is my room, my workshop, my car, my friends, and it's my city. And I love it. It's my life. No, it's not different from...
Yeah. It's for us. Just for us. We enjoy it.
Work is our life. It's our hobby. It's everything.
Designer and furniture maker Nagin Nasseri from Studio On in Tehran. More Tehran stories later this week on The World. War hero, effective manager, probably not terms you'd associate with Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. After all, millions died during his purges of so-called enemies of the people during the late 1930s. But recent polls show that more and more Russians see Stalin in a positive light these days. So a group of activists has launched a memorial project they hope will hammer home the human cost of Stalin's achievements. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford reports from Moscow.
The metal plaques are small and simple, but each whir of the drill fixes another one in place and another name in history. There are now dozens of these nameplates across Moscow, marking the last known address of those executed on the orders of Joseph Stalin.
Well, Sergei's just screwing the last of the plaques to the wall. There's a little crowd that's gathered here, stopped on this tourist street in the centre of Moscow to see what this is all about.
The human rights activists behind the project say residents sometimes refuse the plaques, calling them depressing, or saying that they don't want their houses turned into a cemetery. Olga strongly disagrees.
This is my grandfather, Mikhail Andreevich Zelenino. And today he's getting something due to him. You know, this is not just a civil ceremony. There is something sacred about that. And, you know, this is so very important that people now can read the names of people who disappeared completely in time.
And he was a linguist, an academic. Why was he arrested?
This is perhaps that they feared words.
As well as academics and artists, Communist Party officials, factory workers, even housewives were among the hundreds of thousands shot during the Great Terror, Stalin's purge, which reached its frenzied height in 1937 and 38. The eerie soundtrack at a new Moscow museum to the repressions is a mix of wind whistling through the labour camps and the creak of prison doors, and slowly scrolling up one wall are the execution lists. But step out of here, and you're more likely to hear Russians today talking of Stalin as an effective manager or as a war hero than as a tyrant. And just last week, I watched a nationalist mob chant 1937 at opposition activists and scream for new purges. Roman Romanov is the Gulag Museum director.
Russians were never forced to face up to what happened. When the archives were opened, even when our museum opened, people protested that we didn't need it. I think it's a natural reaction to deny tragic history or pain, but we have to overcome that.
On the edge of Moscow, behind a heavy wooden gate, there's an even starker reminder of why.
Well, stepping through the crisp snow here in the forest, and I've reached an area where I can see photographs pinned to the trees, just the laminated printouts, most of them, some of them with the plastic flowers taped beneath as well. Like this one here, I'm just looking at. Tsivtsivadze, Ilya Venediktovich. Executed March 1938. I don't know his particular story yet, of course, but there are thousands of people like him lying in the ground here beneath the trees. Anna and Maria were visiting Komunarka for the first time. The sisters show me a photo of their grandfather, Genrikh Rubinstein. He was a Soviet railways manager, killed in September 1938.
There are people who don't want to know about this, especially young people, who are taught history in such a way now that these millions of victims are justified. They say, well, we leapt forward, we created a country of tanks from a country of plows. So they were victims, so what?
The Orthodox Church is in charge of the land here now, but the mass graves still haven't been marked out, and the only memorials are those left by relatives. Back in the city centre, though, the number of metal plaques is growing, as Olga looks up at her own grandfather's name, now attached to the house that he was taken from to be shot. She tells me the last address project is critical.
We need more occasions when young people can start asking questions or start thinking about things. If we don't provide these occasions, so there will be no hope for future.
One of the activists behind the last address project in Moscow, ending that report from the BBC's Sarah Rainsford. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Every morning I make my coffee on the stove using a version of the Italian mocha pot. It's that little aluminum percolator with a picture of a man on its side. He's got a huge handlebar mustache. Now, the man who made it, a worldwide brand, Renato Bialetti, died recently, and we're going to talk more about him in a moment. But first, let's talk about another way of brewing. Coffee pods. Several members of my family use them, and yeah, they're handy, but as I keep telling my kinfolk, not so great for the environment. That's why the city of Hamburg, Germany, banned them from all state-run buildings. Jens Kirsten helped make that happen. He's the regional minister for environment and energy in Hamburg. So why ban coffee pods? Tell us what your rationale was here.
Coffee pods are very bad for the environment. First of all, they produce lots of waste. You have 3 grams of coffee and 6 grams of package. And on the other hand, you use lots of energy for all this aluminum and plastic. And so in the end, it's a very bad business.
Right. So you're not banning them altogether in Hamburg for people who just want them for personal use. They can. But in state-run buildings, it's out, right?
That's right. Because we think it's a bad idea spending taxpayers' money on those pads because they are ridiculously expensive, and it's not a good use of taxpayers' money.
Yeah, so wasteful and expensive. And the news that coffee pods are bad for the environment, are people in Hamburg who use them, is this a discovery for them? Are they kind of waking up and smelling the coffee, as it were?
Well, we have started really lots of discussion, and even some civil servants came to me and asked me, well, it's okay if they buy them privately. I mean, that's not the idea behind our plan. But in the end, people start thinking about it and discussing with their family or with colleagues. And I think in the end, that's the best way. I mean, of course, we can't forbid it for people using it. But in the end, if you look at all the effects you produce with your decision to buy those coffee pots, I mean, it's fairly easy to see that that's, in the end, not a good idea using coffee pots.
Are other cities around Germany taking notice of what you're doing in Hamburg? And will they also ban them for state-run buildings, do you think?
Well, I haven't heard of another city banning them yet, but actually we get lots of questions to talk about this. So I think we were quite right starting this discussion right now.
You drink coffee yourself?
Yes, I do.
How do you brew it?
Well, actually, I'm really using a very old-fashioned coffee machine, or for espresso, I have some fancy devices doing it.
You wouldn't happen to use the mocha pot for espresso on the stovetop, do you?
Well, a mocha pot, yeah, that's something what I use sometimes.
Good way to go.
They taste much better even than those pods. When I was talking to Italian media, I mean, they confirmed that very much, that they thought, well, mocha pots and other things are much better for the taste.
Yeah, I would have to concur with that. Jens Kirsten, Regional Minister for Environment and Energy in Hamburg, Germany. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Jens agrees mocha pots do make a pretty darn good cup of coffee, and it's thanks to the little man with the mustache I mentioned earlier. Renato Bialetti was the Italian businessman who made the stovetop Mocha Express famous. He died earlier this month at the age of 93. Now, there are millions of these Bialetti coffee makers in kitchens throughout the world, and some coffee drinkers think they are the best.
My name is Mario Rizzotti. I am an Italian culinary specialist. Also a judge on Iron Chef America.
I am Renata Rosso. I was born and I grew up in Italy, and I live in New York City.
It was always with us. It was part of our family. Bialetti was with us when we were laughing, when we were crying, when we were having lunch or dinner. They were always actually a part of our family. He's been there for ages, and we always have the little man with the long mustache and the long hat staring at us and making sure that we were having the best espresso machine in the house, and we were happy what they brought to our house.
In those years, yeah, in Italy, there was this, it was called Carosello. It's like a short commercial. So, and it was like around 8:30, 9 o'clock in the evening. So, you know, usually your parents would tell you, oh, you go to bed after Carosello, you know. So basically we were watching this little cartoon, and the Bialetti was very funny, you know, this short man with this big mustache. And basically when he was talking, his lips had the shape of all the letters of the alphabet. So, and he had this famous line saying, sembra facile, you know, it seems easy, you know, to make a coffee, but it is not. But if you have the right tools or the right machine, you can make one as good as the one that you can drink at a coffee place. In Italian, it was buono come al bar. So, you know, this line does stick in your head.
Sembra facile. Ma da oggi è facile. Sì, sì, perché da oggi sopra le caffettiere Mocha Express.
So I still have my mocha here in New York, my Bialetti mocha, and I have three sizes. So when, you know, one if I have by myself, or if I have one friend, or a big one when I have some guest coming. And I don't like any coffee that comes from a pod. I like to grind my coffee every morning. Fresh aroma, exuding aroma, for me is like a nice prelude to a new day.
Unfortunately, I never had the pleasure to meet Mr. Bialetti. But in my memories, I will always be the little gentleman in black and white that sticks his finger up in the air, with a little nice pointy hat, with his big mustache, that is making sure that he's there, because that's the stamp of the quality of a good espresso machine. And now that he's no longer with us, I hope that he brought his espresso machine in heaven, so they can have some good espresso up there too.
Perché lo sapete anche voi che la caffettiera Mocha Express è un prodotto Bialetti.
Renato Bialetti did get a very appropriate send-off. His ashes were placed in a giant version of his iconic mocha pot. and then blessed by a priest before burial. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Arrivederci.
PRI, Public Radio International.